We live in a broken province, in a broken country, in a broken world. And when I mean broken, the spirit of the people is broken, and they don't care how much you're put upon by governments or false pieties or false philosophies. They've sacrificed the consequence of their own individual sovereignty to fear, to money, and to a complete retreat from reason. We're going to be covering some of these topics today. You've heard in the news today about the judge who refused to grant the injunction on the anti-smoking challenge, on the challenge to the no-smoking law. And not on the grounds, by the way, that it didn't have merit. The judge quite actually said that rights are being affected, and this is the way law is made, but that judge wasn't going to make an injunction. So whatever was suffered by the people economically or in any other way would have to wait till played out in the courts. So rights are not rights in Quebec, one can suppose. But this shouldn't be a surprise. Bill 37, on Friday, the health minister wanted the medical specialist to be called back to the table, but he wasn't willing to reverse any part of Bill 37. Bill 37, which is the law that Quebec government pushed through to get the medical specialist back to work and to accept wage levels, makes it illegal for them to even talk about it in terms of a challenge. They can't challenge it. They can't refuse to work under the conditions of Bill 37. And if a specialist wants to leave Quebec, there's even fines that can be imposed under Bill 37. People don't understand that we're living in a proto-Stalinist environment. Things are going to get even more and more serious. Nationally, major study today that shows half of Canadians are one or two paychecks away from the poverty level. We've got a rich society, but with a very thin veneer of affluence. Just drowning in debt. No one takes our public policymakers to task for not addressing this most serious of public policy issues. And you know what's at the heart of all this? People don't care about freedom anymore. They don't care about their own liberty because it demands that they stand up. It demands that they take responsibility. George Bernard Shaw wrote that liberty demands responsibility, and that's why so many dread it. Well, our first guest tonight and in studio, and we're very proud to have him here, is Professor Peter March. Professor March will be speaking tomorrow at Concordia University at the Hall Building, room H435, at 8:30. And Peter March doesn't dread responsibility. He embraces it. When political media and academic leaders are falling over themselves, pandering to radical Islamists over the Muhammad cartoon affair, Peter March stood firm, acted boldly, and spoke truth to power. He made clear that freedom of expression is indivisible. Quebec may not think so, but it's indivisible. That it remains the shield of the free and the staff of the just, and no attempt at compromising this most sacred of our public trust for the sake of appeasing violent enemies of liberty can never be justified. A professor of logic at St. Mary's University in Halifax, March posted copies of the Muhammad cartoons on his office door as both a statement of academic freedom and a protest against those seeking to stifle any debate on campuses on the egregiously violent Islamic reactions to their original publication. Though told by administrative officials to take them down, March persisted and all complaints against him have been dropped. March said at the time, "I feel threatened by the crowds around the world shaking fists, shaking sticks, burning things down. I want to make my stand that here in Canada, this won't wash." And he took a stand then, and we need to stand with him now. And his arguments are going to be very, very compelling. And they'll present a vision for the possibilities of a reformation of our multicultural society, of our pluralistic pandering in Canada, and a desperate need for the reformation of the statist faith so that Islam and democracy can coexist. Once again, this lecture is open to the public. We encourage you to attend tomorrow at 8:30 at Concordia University in room H435. And right after this short break, we're going to talk to Professor Peter March. And star 940 on Rogers if you're on your cell, pound 940 if you're on Bell. And we're privileged to have with us in studio Professor Peter March of St. Mary's University in Halifax, who's on a self-funded independent speaking tour. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at Concordia University in room H435 at 8:30 p.m. on Islam and democracy. Can they coexist? The urgency of reforming statist faith. Welcome, Peter.
Good evening, Barrow.
We know what you did with the cartoons. You made a statement by posting them on the door. You stood in the face of academic administration. But what made you hit the road with this message? What was the urgency of now?
Well, the reaction of the academics, above all, it was very sad to see that particularly the female academics had no sense at all that Islam is a culture of slavery. And that in any culture, virtually where Islam has power, women become slaves. They become domestic and sexual slaves of their men. One would have thought that that reality would have provoked a large reaction from among so-called feminists and other women in the academic community, but it didn't. But there are many other things that need to be said, which are considered to be insensitive, perhaps harsh, controversial. All these things are being suppressed in the interests of sensitivity, being nice about things, and being multicultural, above all. And I just thought there it would do some good if at least one person went out and simply said these things. And, of course, it was a complete waste of time asking for anyone to support such a tour, where you'd come out and just say the plain truth. And so here I am.
Yet what you're saying, particularly about the role of women, the Institute held a conference on questions of value and ways of response to radical Islam. All the speakers are women, not because we chose them, because women seem to be the main spokespeople against radical Islam. These were women from Islamic countries. So what you're saying mirrors exactly what they're saying, but you're going further. You're saying that, okay, that's there, but there are some things we have to do in this country, in Canada. We need a reformation of Islam in Canada to make it livable in a pluralistic environment.
That's right. If half the population of a voting group is in a state of slavery, there's simply no reality to the concept of democracy. If Islam is going to come into a democratic culture, then we're going to have to be rid of the fundamental relationship between men and women in Islam, which is a relationship in which the male is absolutely dominant and indeed very often has the power of life and death over the women around him. So we have to crack that. We also have to crack the notion that the man is a slave to his religion. That's a second level of slavery. I think once we see that at the root, Islam is enslaving a huge number of women and, in fact, enslaving the slavers themselves to a religion, then we'll begin to understand why there has to be a reformation. And I think the women are the obvious place to start that reformation. Now, they're the one who are speaking up and saying exactly that. Islam has to change now. And that, I suspect, is the way it's going to be. If we can convince Islamic women to come to university, to get their education, to get some training so they can get their own jobs, then Islam, at least in Canada, will wither on the bough. There will emerge a completely different religion from the one that we know today.
What is the danger of our current multicultural, touchy-feely policies in this country to achieving that kind of goal, to speaking clearly and candidly about the problems of a particular group?
Well, the Islamic culture, of course, is extremely aggressive in demanding its rights. Islam, unlike Christianity...
But we have problems in Canada with addressing any problems of any group. It's like collective rights are sacrosanct.
Absolutely. And let me put it shortly. If we don't address Islam with firmness, it will stand as an example to every other group that they can get whatever they want. And that, in long term, will prove to be absolutely unworkable.
Every other group seems to be getting whatever they want in this country, but it's screaming enough.
It'll become unstable and unworkable, and the whole apparatus of social services, et cetera, will become seriously gummed up. In countries like Holland, Muslims are now pulling three times as much social services money out of the system as the per capita of the non-Muslims. And it's perfectly clear that there's going to be an enormous price to pay if we allow ourselves to end up where countries like the Netherlands have ended up.
Peter, hold that thought. We have to take a short break, and we're going to come back talk about the political consequences of non-response by Western nations and what has changed in Canada since the Harper government. We'll be right back with Peter March. And you can email us later with your comments at info@iapm.ca. And we're privileged to have in studio Professor Peter March of St. Mary's University in Halifax, who's on a speaking tour on Islam and democracy. Peter, are you heartened at all by the change in Canadian foreign policy, at least the signals we're sending out into this prime minister, who said to Hamas, no more money until you renounce violence, who said to Iran, who demanded the arrest of the Iranian prosecutor, Saeed Mortazawi, the man who kills, one of the men who kills Ara Kazemi, the Montreal photojournalist, a prime minister who says at La Francophonie, no, we're going to have balanced resolutions in the Middle East. He's speaking on the world stage, he's speaking truth to Islamic power. Is that going to have an effect within Canada? The titles of your talks are Islam and Democracy. Are not only Muslims but other groups going to understand that we have overriding principles that are not going to be compromised?
That message will sink in, Beryl. But it's going to take a very long time, because Canada has treated her foreign policy as a commercial matter for 30 years now. And in those 30 years, we have compromised absolutely everything in the interest of trade. And in one sense, it has worked. In another, we have become totally discredited, I think, from the point of view of our moral stance. We have absolutely no guts in going into the international sphere and standing out for people's individual rights and the rights of groups in other countries. Harper has started. Harper has started. And that's extremely important. I do hope that when the time comes to speak directly to Islam in Canada, that he will show as much spine as he is showing now with the Chinese, etc.
You and I were talking off the air, and you said you're a child of the 60s, and so am I, at least late 60s and early 70s. But I still remember in that period that people like Senator Henry Jackson and Charles Vanek in the United States stood up to the Soviet Union on political rights, passed the Jackson-Vanek Amendment, took away most favored nation status. What happened to that will?
Oh, it was signaled by when the diplomatic corps in Canada was told point blank in the 70s, from now on, the number one priority of the diplomatic corps is going to be trade. At that point, everyone got the message that the business of diplomacy is the business of commerce. And when that closure occurred, from then on, I believe any ambassador would choke on the thought of interfering with a trade deal by raising human rights issues. And when that decision was made to use the diplomatic corps as an advertising agency, at that point, Canada's spirit began to die publicly.
What I find amusing is, as much as you're frustrated with the world of academe, I'm frustrated with media who can't get their heads around the fact that this prime minister is delivering a message that has absolutely gives him nothing. He has nothing to gain from delivering this message. He's got his base vote. He won't make that grow anymore. They can't get their heads around the fact that there's a man of principle standing there on this issue, and they're always looking to decrease the issue and to marginalize it and to minimize it. It's a remarkable thing. The lines are filling up. Let's just take one quick phone call. Leslie, good evening.
Hey, good evening, Beryl.
You're on the air.
Okay, I'd like to say that I think you're being very critical of the Muslim religion. Well, not you, your guest. And a lot of what goes on isn't from the Muslim religion, it's from the patriarchy that was the background of these countries before a Muslim ever came into existence.
Yes, I think that's a valid point. I call it Islamic culture, not to be confused with Islam or comments about the Quran. And cultures have a history, you're quite right.
And I think that in every religion there are extremists, including the Muslim religion.
There I can't buy that. There are extremists. They're the soldiers. The other people stand in support. When I start hearing the vast majority of Muslims objecting to the way the bombers, etc., are behaving, then yes, I will think there are just extremists and the others are okay. But when they maintain the silence, they are the support troops.
Leslie, I think the frustration is we don't. The media used to talk about the Arab street and the radical Islamists. Where are the marches by Muslims against Muslims killing Muslims? Muslims have killed more Muslims than they've killed anybody else. Where are the marches against acid being thrown in the face of girls that have the temerity to go to school? You know, 70, 80, 90% of the girls in Iraq and Afghanistan are now going to school, where before it was 10 to 15%. In other words, where are these moderate voices? It's not enough to say, I'm a moderate. You've got to put yourself on the line.
all of these countries have people who are moderate, who are doing their best to bring out their positions. You
well,
can't
we
paint everyone with one brush.
I hope you're right, Leslie. The time is running. I hope you're right, but we haven't seen them, and that's why we need voice like Peter March's, and I hope we'll see you tomorrow night.
Well, Peter's voice is just going to enhance stereotypes of the Muslims being all radical or...
Well... he's talking about parts of the Muslim world, and unfortunately, they're not stereotypes. They've proven to be all too real. Leslie, thanks for calling. We've got to go to news. We'll be right back. And staying in studio with us is Professor Peter March, who'll be speaking tomorrow at Concordia University in room H435 at 8:30 on Islam and democracy. And we've been talking this half hour, and we've been talking to callers about perceptions out there. And one of the nastiest perceptions in the past week on the questions of political Islam, the questions of Islamic extremism have come about from the United Nations Human Rights Council. Last Thursday, they voted again to condemn Israel for its attacks into Gaza after Israel had suffered over 2,000 Qassam rocket attacks, destroying the town of Sderot. We had Hillel Noiron, the executive director of UN Watch, who delivered a very stirring and stern address at the UN Human Rights Council, warning them of their hypocrisy, and this misinformation and disinformation campaign continues on what is a proportional response when your country is suffering the destruction of a city under the cover of terrorists working behind human shields. And to talk a little bit about that, we're privileged to have Consul General Mark Attali, Israeli Consul General in Montreal, with us on the line. Good evening, Mark.
Good evening.
When the Israel responds and makes a mistake in a bombing, it suddenly takes headlines. How come we don't see more headlines about the fact that we've had Israeli civilians, Israeli towns destroyed, and thousands of rocket attacks under shields in Gaza, not just in Lebanon? Why is that message not getting out there?
Well, you know, Bill, you've been in this business as a journalist for many years now. And I'm also asking the question, how come hundreds of journalists that are foreign journalists, who basically are posted in Israel and they live in Israel and they see the daily life in Israel, how come they don't report the fact that they are seeing? And unfortunately, going back to the Gaza issue that you mentioned, unfortunately, it's again a deja vu of a situation that keeps happening and happening over and over again. Again, in a totally... ignoring of terrorism, continuing terrorism of the Palestinian terrorist organization against the citizens of Israel. And we have a resolution of the UN supported by the 156 countries condemning Israel. That's ridiculous. I mean, how can we trust such an organization that automatically the Arab group and their supporters have an automatic majority? They can pass any resolution they want.
And they have, as Hillel Noyer pointed out last Thursday, the UN Human Rights Council has almost to the exclusion of every other problem in the world passed resolutions only in Israel. Such wonderful human rights countries on that Human Rights Council, such as Cuba and China, just sterling examples of human rights.
You know something, human rights, I mean, blaming Israel when it comes to human rights issue, it's really a total ignorance what Israel is about. But unfortunately, this country, since 1948, when this country was created, basically what we see in the international arena, it's an ongoing bashing of the state of Israel. Think about it. The whole world is a gathering together in order to discuss a military operation in Gaza. Yes, citizens were killed, and it's a tragic event. But can you imagine yourself, I mean, can you really believe that intentionally Israel is targeting the Gazan population?
I don't think they believe it. I think this is...
I don't understand.
It becomes a moral resort.
When it comes to Israel, automatically inquiries, you know something? Israel don't need outside inquiries in order to investigate what's going on within Israel. We know how to do it. And when we have to apologize, we apologize. But one thing we will never apologize. We never apologize when it comes to the fact that there are those who are their only goal is the destruction of the state of Israel. Let me give you some figures about Gaza.
Mark, can we get to the figures in 1 second? We have to take a very short break. I'll be right back with Consul General Mark Attali of Israel. And we're talking to Israeli Consul General Montreal, Mark Attali, on the latest UN feeding frenzy about the Israeli defensive attacks in Gaza. And Mark, you were saying before the break you were about to get into some numbers.
Yeah, I was about to give some numbers, and just I would like to remind us that 1 year ago, more than a year ago, Israel totally withdrew from the Gaza Strip, giving the Palestinians, for the first time in their history, a window of opportunity and to seize an occasion in order for once and for all to govern themselves. But what did we get in return? The election of the Hamas terrorist organization. Israel is no longer in Gaza. This is something that sometimes we tend to forget. We are not there. However, Gaza turned into a terrorist base. As one Israeli commentator said on one of the Israeli websites, Gaza turned into Cape Canaveral. You know, the number of missiles have been launched from Gaza into the Israeli soil. And let me give you some numbers.
Over 2,000.
Let me give you some numbers about a part of the missiles that you just mentioned. In the past few months, 33 tons of military-grade as explosive were bringing into Gaza, 20,000 assault rifles, 3,000 pistols, 6 million bullets, 38 long-range artillery missiles, 12 shoulder anti-aircraft missiles, 95 anti-tank rockets, 410 anti-tank rocket launchers, and etc., etc., etc. What do they need it for? Tell me, what do they need it for? It's not in order to launch a terrorist attack against Israel. And unfortunately, what we've seen at the UN, this, I would say, again, a kind of a circus. What kind of message the UN is delivering to all of those today who are supporting terrorism? If not an encouragement, yes, you know, we're gonna carry out investigation, etc., etc. That's the message.
I think
the whole world is preoccupied with an incident, although tragic, but let's face one reality. Israel is under constant attack. It's either in Gaza Strip, and it was up until a few months ago in Lebanon. We are in the front line against the radical Islam. We are in the front line against those regimes who support radical Islam. That by now, I guess, everybody knows. We are talking about Iran. We are talking about Syria. Their only goal is to eliminate and to bring to the destruction not only of the state of Israel, but everything that represents democracy.
Everything in the West. Israel's just a little Satan. You know, this is what Professor March was talking about, that can radical Islam coexist with democracy? It's the very freedoms that Israel has, that the West has, that irritate the hell out of the people who are keeping their own populations as prisoners. But let me ask you this. It's been suggested that Israel, unlike the Palestinian Authority, unlike the Lebanese, don't show severed limbs of bodies on television. Don't take around correspondence like they did with Nick Robertson in the same 10-block area to the point where Robertson had to resign from the Beirut posting because he had to admit that his reports were fraudulent, that there wasn't that much destruction, but Hezbollah was blackmailing the correspondence. Does Israel have to go on a very nasty PR offensive and start showing the world the brutality of the Arab attacks against it, the brutal results of it in human terms, see visually?
First of all, when it comes to human lives and the respect, not only of human lives, the respect also of dead people, I don't think we have to play the same nasty game that they are playing to show blood and bodies on television. This is in our tradition and our Jewish value. This is not something that belongs to our culture. This is the first thing. But the second, however, that as I told you at the beginning of our conversation, hundreds of foreign journalists are there in Israel. And how come whatever comes out of Israel is always negative? Or let's say most of the time, it's negative when it comes to Israel. It's a kind of a wrong perception of what Israel is about and what Israel is dealing with. The only democracy in the world, in the Middle East, that find himself in a region that is everything but the respect of democracy. And this is our neighborhood. And we have to understand we are in the front line of those mutations that the world is going through. The fight against those who basically, their victory is more bloodshed and more dead people. Their victory is the destruction of everything that represents our values of democracy and free world.
And that is as good a note as any to end this conversation at, because that is precisely what the theme of tonight has been. How do you reform a status faith that is becoming a theocratic tyranny that is threatening in a wave to destroy Western freedom. And tiny Israel is the frontline nation in it. And it's time that people get it. Consul General Mark Attali of Israel, we thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Well, we leave the world stage and let's go to Canada for the last part of the hour. There was a really compelling study and a shocking headline that half of Canadians think they're one or two paychecks away from poverty. It was a study carried out by Environics for the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, and we're very pleased to have economist Armine Yelnizian of the center with us tonight. Armine, good evening.
Hi there, Beryl. How are you tonight?
Very well. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
My pleasure.
What does this study say to you about the great vision that people normally have of Canada?
Well, certainly, it has both a dark side and a positive side. The poll shows that 76% of Canadians believe that Canada's gap between rich and poor has grown compared to 10 years ago. And you might stop and think, well, that's not very exciting. Three-quarters of the population of Canada believe that the gap is growing at the period. The context is the most brisk economic growth this country's seen since the 60s. In fact, very similar economic conditions to the 1960s, low inflation, low unemployment, governments with very good public books, both at the federal and the provincial level, by and large, across the country, and an economy that's just firing on all cylinders. And yet people believe that in this same period that the gap between rich and poor has grown, and that they themselves are feeling, half of Canadians are feeling deeply economically insecure. And that should give us all a lot of pause about what it means to have an economy that's focused on economic growth, but most Canadians don't seem to feel that they're benefiting. And you know what? The evidence shows that they're absolutely right.
Armine, we'll come right back with you after this short break and continue this discussion. And remember what Mark Twain said, that nobody lives on the averages, and we have all three kinds of lies, damn lies, and statistics. We'll be right back with Armine Yelnizian of the Center for Policy Alternatives. And we're talking to economist Armine Yelnizian with the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives on a new study released today, and a new poll that shows that more than half of Canadians, almost half of Canadians, sorry, feel they're one paycheck away from poverty. Now, Armine, you made the point before the break that we're in this wonderful period of economic growth, statistically, but we don't know where that money's going. Are we basically a wealthy country with a thin veneer of affluence on the one side, and on the other side, those very same corporations that are benefiting from this wonderful growth are encouraging a culture of debt that between that and tax rates that are going sky high, people can't breathe?
Well, I guess you could take a look at the way the trends are going. If you look at the big, big trends, you can see that what it looks like today looks very much like it did in the 1920s in terms of concentration of wealth. And some people's incomes are growing, it's true, but most people's incomes are not growing. And yet our costs are rising dramatically. Our costs of heating our homes, filling our tanks up with gas, sending our kids to school, finding a house that's affordable, and putting the roof over our heads. It's true, interest rates are down at, you know, 40-year lows, but the actual cost of a house has gone up. The real estate value has gone up. So all of these things put families into a real squeeze, the majority of families into a squeeze.
I'm glad you're using the word families, because this report mirrors very much something that came out 6 months ago, and we had the people from the Vanier Institute for the Family
right.
on. And their report showed that from 1993 to 2005, the average family income in this country went up an effective 3%. That's 3% for the entire 13-year period.
Yeah. And in fact, if you take a look at the stats going back to 1980, which is your basic generation, right, 25 years ago compared to now, 25, 26 years ago, they compare a young family today to a family back then, family incomes have essentially stagnated. But the bad news, Beryl, is that more families have got a second person working now. The reason why family incomes have remained is...
I think it's almost impossible for a household not to have two...
Which raises big questions about how we're taking care of ourselves and our kids. We're becoming wage slaves, and we're not actually getting ahead. We're just staying, you know, it's like Alice running faster and faster
right.
to stay on the same spot. And so And though the economy is growing, all those other things are happening, and Canadians have played by all the rules. You know, they're working harder, they're working longer hours, they're doing all the things that they should be doing. It's not translating into benefit for them. The bad part of it politically is they can see that wealth is accumulating all around them. they can see evidence of some people doing a lot
better.
In
a few hands.
And it's creating a real culture of haves and have-nots, which, and I said there was good news and bad news in this poll. The good news is Canadians believe that it doesn't have to be this way. They don't like the direction society is going in. So, yes, there's a huge amount of personal insecurity that is starting to emerge at a time of economic affluence. But Canadians are saying this isn't where we want to go as a society. We don't like this going unchecked, this growing gap going unchecked in good times and bad. And we actually think something can be done about it. And I think that's a really positive and healthy sign that people have not given up, generally speaking. They're not just completely saying, well, nothing can be done, and it's inevitable that the gap keeps growing.
Okay, now, if we don't want to be merely tax-and-spend liberals, and if we don't want to be merely state interventionists who force diffusion of wealth, what is another middle? What is a middle ground for what government policy can be on this?
Well, you know, I have to say that I'm not going to go right into the solutions, because one of the things that was most striking about this poll was the degree of consistency across provinces and across income groups, across gender and across age for these findings. They were really solid all across the country, and very little variation from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Where you started getting differences is the what you could do about it. Not that something could be done. 88% of Canadians believe that something can be done. But the what could be done varies quite a bit from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So you're just going to have to call me back in a couple of months and I'll tell you what we find.
All right. Let me throw out some ideas that I talked to you about before. And I want to share this with our listeners. We live in a society where 5% of the population has a net worth of $5,000 or more. Net worth. I want that to sink in for a moment. Now, if we don't want the government simply to force the diffusion of wealth, we have fully one-third of our federal and provincial budgets going to statocratic programs that have nothing to do with the base job of government. Rollbacks of those programs, reduction of taxes on the working and what can be laughably called middle classes, is a start.
Well, I would argue that the rollback has already taken place over the course of the 1990s. The federal government shrank in the course of six swift years from about 17% of the economy to about 10.8% of the economy. No other nation on the surface of the planet had that contraction of the role of federal government in their lives. The provinces followed suit. And you know that giant sucking sound that Ross Perot used to talk about
right.
during one of those presidential elections about jobs going south of the border? Well, in Canada, from 1995 to 1998, the giant sucking sound was the sound of the federal government leaving the building. Like, what they took in their wake was people losing their safety nets across this country. In 1989, we had 75% of unemployed people in this country who pay their premiums along with their bosses to be covered by unemployment insurance when they're unemployed. 75% of the unemployed were eligible and received benefits in 1989. By today, I'll tell you, across the country, it's 35%, and in Toronto, where I live, it's 22%. They pay, they're unemployed, and they can't get access to their own benefits. And the response of the federal government right now, to reduce premiums. That isn't what people need. That is what's leading to economic insecurity across this country.
Armand, you're quite right. We're up against the clock. I'd like to continue this conversation tomorrow night, and I'm going to give you a very surprising number to balance off yours about government involvement, okay? Can you be with us tomorrow night?
I will try and commit once I take a look at my schedule.
Okay, we're up against the clock. Thank you. Thank you, Montreal. We want to remind you again, Professor Peter March at Concordia University, tomorrow night, 8:30, room H435. We're out of here. Thank you, Tor Sjogren.